Thanks everyone for coming. Today we're gonna implement a component-based entity system using modern C++ techniques, using C++ 14. And the talk is gonna have 10 minutes of slides, and then we're gonna jump into code and just implement step-by-step the component system. If you want to follow along, everything I'm gonna use during the talk is available on that GitHub repository, so you can download it. So let's begin by talking about what an entity is. So an entity, in my opinion, is something that is tied to a specific concept and has related data and or logic. We usually deal with many entities when programming an entity component system or any kind of entity system, but we also may want to track specific instances. We want to make sure they're alive, or we want to do something with particular instances. Also, entities can be obviously created and destroyed. And as some simple examples, we may have game objects such as a player, the bullet, or a car, or GUI widgets such as windows, textbox, and buttons. That's our examples of entities, in my opinion. So we need to encode entities, and there are many approaches of doing this. The easiest approach, and the one that's most traditional, is using OOP inheritance. Basically, every entity is a part of an inheritance where we have a base entity type with virtual functions. Data and logic are both stored inside the entities, the classes themselves, and logic is handled using runtime polymorphism, so by overriding virtual functions. The benefit of this approach is that it's very, very easy to implement. You just have to override methods and just put the data inside your entity classes. The problems are that it is very cache unfriendly, as we have a lot of overhead because of the virtual calls and heap allocations, and also it's very unflexible. So let me show you what I mean. If you're making a game and we have a skeleton, for example, and we want to have a skeleton with a sword and with a shield, we may have two different classes that inherit from the base skeleton class. But the problem is, what if we want a skeleton with both a sword and a shield? Then the idea of inheritance becomes difficult because we may have to use multiple inheritance, and we know that's not fun to work with. An example of code of this approach is basically having an entity struct with a virtual destructor, update, and draw methods for a game, for example, and then just deriving the entities from the base class. And we override the update and put the data inside the derived classes to deal with logic and data. Another approach is object-oriented composition, where an entity is actually an aggregate of components. And by component, I mean a small part of the entity that does something and does some related data. So the entity itself does not have any data or logic. It just stores these components, and the components have data and logic. Logic is still handled using runtime polymorphism. We have a base component class from which our components derive from and override those methods. And the good things about this OOP composition approach is that it's very easy to implement. It's as easy as the previous approach. It's more flexible. We can solve the problems that we had with the multiple inheritance example. But it's still cache unfriendly because we have a lot of heap allocations. And there is the runtime overhead caused by virtual functions and override calls. So an example of the previous problem is like having these skeleton entities, and there is no inheritance. We're actually composing the logic and the data of these game objects by adding those components inside the entity at runtime. An example of code is having like a struct component, which is very similar to our previous entity class. And the components are where we define the data and the logic. And the entity is just a container of components. We're using unique pointer here for polymorphism. And we have some helper methods that just loop over the components and perform logic. So when we want to make a specific entity, we just override your component, and we put some data and logic in it by overriding. And the actual creation of the entity is done through functions. We just instantiate an entity and add components to it at runtime and return the entity. So this is a better approach than the previous one, but we still have those disadvantages. What I'm going to implement today, step by step, is DOD composition. DOD is data-oriented design. Now take this expression with a grain of salt because it's something relatively complex, and there are many ideas about data-oriented design. My idea of data-oriented is like having the data stored contiguously in a potentially cache-friendly way, trying to think about the position of the data before the design of the game objects or the GUI widgets, for example. In this case, an entity is still an aggregate of components, but components are logicless. They do not store any kind of logic. We can think of components as simple, plain old data structures with just data in them. And logic is used is handled using systems. So basically, we have a system that looks for entities matching a specific set of components, and they perform logic upon those entities. So the good things about this approach is a potential cache friendliness if we actually manage to store the data contiguously and at runtime we hope it will get in the correct cache lines. There is minimal runtime overhead because we do not have any kind of virtual call or override at runtime. And it's very flexible. As you can see, we can think of this approach like a relational database table where we can just stick the components that a certain entity has. The problem is that it can be very hard to implement, especially for beginners, instead of an inheritance-based approach. So the previous example, you can see that our skeletons now are just rows in a table, and we just stick the components that those particular instances have. And then we can have those systems that perform some logic upon entities, and they automatically find out which entities match the specific signature and just perform some logic on them. So there is this nice separation between data and logic that can be also used to easily serialize stuff and send it over the network. It's very, very convenient. You can think of these systems as some kind of keys that try to fit into entities, and if they fit into the specific entity, then we can say that the entity matches the signature of the system. In that case, the system will perform logic upon that entity. An example of code is like having the entity as a single numerical ID, so there is no entity class here. We might have a max entities context value for our limit of entities. The components are simple structs without any kind of inheritance, and they will contain only data, not logic. And our manager, our context, will basically have an array for every type of component long enough to support the maximum number of entities. So is there any questions so far? Okay. So what we're going to implement today is a DoD composition system, very simple one. I'm not claiming to have the perfect component-based system. It's just to show people how the traditional inheritance-based approach can be kind of difficult to work with, and various alternatives such as the DoD composition. And what we're going to implement today is something that needs to know at compile time what kind of components we have. The components themselves will be simple logicless classes. Entities will be lightweight objects. They will have their own ID and some metadata to store the information about their components and tags and handles. So they will be very lightweight objects. We won't have an explicit system class or inheritance of systems. Actually, we will use just signatures, and we will offer the user methods to loop over entities with a specific signature, and the users themselves may be interested in implementing systems using that signatures. So systems are implicit. A signature would be just a bit set, where every bit corresponds to a specific component type or tag, and the entities can obviously be created by signature. One of the problems in implementing this kind of system is thinking about the storage of components. So what we've seen earlier is just storing one array per component type. So this is very easy to implement. You just have a list of component types at compile time and just store them into arrays. You can think of the arrays as a table, where the columns are the entities. So for example, entity with the index tree holds all three components. So this is very easy to implement compared to the other approaches. It is suitable for most projects, and it's very easy to add and remove components at runtime. The problem is that it can be cache-friendlier. For example, if we stored all the components of the single entity right next to each other, we would have no possibility of cache misses. And the most obvious problem is that's wasteful of memory, because we have to allocate enough space for all the entities that we are going to support in our system, so there are going to be empty slots that waste memory. Another approach that's more difficult to implement but potentially better is having us just a very, very big single buffer, and we use some indexing tables that are very lightweight and will be loaded into the cache very easily and will not blow up the cache, that just track the various components for specific entities. The problem with this approach is just the implementation. It's very hard to get it right, especially if you want to support component addition or removal at runtime. You have to keep track of the free slots in the array. You have to make sure you can compress the memory around. And if you want to add a component to a specific entity after it's
it has been instantiated, you need to find a space inside the mega buffer, and it probably would get a cache miss if it's if there are no free slots near the other components. So what we're going to do today is just a light coding example with multiple code segments, and I'm going to show you the train of thought behind the implementation of a DoD composition system, a very simple one. So we'll start by a very simple OOP implementation of a simple shoot 'em up game, and we'll gradually transition to a component-based approach. So I'll show you what actually is the process of implementing such a system. We will have the storage type as one array per type approach for simplicity, but we'll also implement some additional features, handles, that will allow us to keep track of specific instances of the entities, and tags that will be just dataless components. There will be a very heavy usage of model-specific features. We'll use variety template metaprogramming, tuples, auto, so I hope you're familiar with that. And I'll try to use a more functional approach where possible. I personally like passing functions to other functions, and this, will, for example, will be used when looping over entities that match a specific signature. We'll use the SFML library for input window rendering. It's a very lightweight library that just wraps OpenGL features and the operating system features just to create windows and render shades and so on. So let's dive into the OOP approach. I'm not going to spend much time on it because I want to get to the data-oriented implementation. But I just want to show you, we have some boilerplate code here, and we define our application by deriving from this test app class here. And we define the logic of our application by overriding update and roll. That's basically it. So in our design for the OOP implementation, we have a context class called manager, where we store unique pointers to entities in a single vector. And then we group those entities based on some tags given by the user in a std map, where the keys are the tags and the values are vectors of row pointers. So the ownership is in the entities vector, while the groups is just for convenience to loop over specific entities. And as you can see, we just have to create our own hierarchy, inheritance hierarchy, and we can start to see how unflexible this is, because we have to define shapes for objects and bullets, we have to define shapes for the physics, for the physics system, and if we want to mix and match those, we could use type erasure, or we just have to create a very big separate branch of the inheritance. So this is a demonstration of how unflexible it can get. So in this OOP approach, the objects will all derive from a base class called GameObject, which will have virtual update and roll methods and some other utility methods, maybe a flag here to check if the memory has to be reclaimed. And the manager will have those containers that I showed you in the diagram. It will have a vector of unique pointer of objects, and we use unique pointers to allow polymorphism, and a map of row pointers to game objects just to group them for convenience. That's basically it. So we can use the erase remove medium here to just take care of all the dead entities efficiently. We can use here the type ID keyword to get the a unique hash for all the types so that we can group them inside the map. And we use emplacement, we perfect forwarding. It's a very, very simple implementation of an inheritance-based approach. Now, as you can see, for every single game object, we have to define a class and derive from game object, which is the base class, and just define our data and logic inside those classes by using override and just adding some data members. So at the end of this approach, after defining all the classes and hopefully trying to minimize repetition, we get something like this when it compiles. So it's a simple shoot 'em up game where we have the bullets, an enemy, and we can move around, kill the boss, and get killed by a bullet. It's a very simple implementation. I just want to show you the difference between the OOP implementation and the data-oriented implementation. So let's just jump into the data-oriented implementation. Let's start by taking a look at the hierarchy that we had in our previous implementation. And as you can see here, that the issue is that we try to share data, small pieces of data, between those branches of the inheritance, but we cannot do that without creating new branches. So what we're looking for is small pieces of data and logic that are the components. So This is the difference I was talking about earlier. Inheritance is a tree of polymorphic object. Composition is just a table where we give specific components to entities or types. Let's think about how we're going to implement this framework by breaking down our architecture in separate elements. So we'll have the component. The component is a simple, logicless, data-containing struct. The component list will be a compile-time list of components types. The tag will be a simple struct without logic or data. It will just be used to mark specific entities. And the tag list will be a compile-time list of tag types. We will have signatures, which are compile-time lists mixed with tag types and component types. And we will use those to match entities to systems and perform logic on them. And we will also have a list of signatures at compile time. Now, the entity is a simple struct, lightweight struct, that's pointing through indices to the correct component data. It also will contain a bit set to keep track of the components and tags that the entity currently has, and a flag to check if the entity is alive that will be used in the context class to just reclaim memory and deal with deletion. The manager is the content class. It will contain entities, components, signatures, and other metadata, and it will deal with the entity and component addition or removal, and iteration of entity matching with specific signatures, handles, and much more. This is the class that will be used as the interface between the user and the entity component system. We'll also add handles in a later code segment, which are a layer of indirection between the entities and the user, and they can be used to keep track of specific entity instances. The good thing about handles is that they are like pointers, but they are not really pointers. We just have some metadata in them, so they can be serialized and stored into the state, maybe in a file or something else. So it's very, very portable and flexible. So let's start by defining our basic elements in the ECS namespace. For this presentation, I've implemented a simple metaprogramming library, which does basic stuff with lists of types, but every existing metaprogramming library will do fine. Feel free to ask questions during these code segments, so don't worry about waiting until the end. So the idea behind the framework is that first we define a settings struct that takes some types, and the settings will take the component list, the tag list, and signature list that the user will define in advance, and we wrap all those settings in a single struct that then will be passed to our manager and our inner classes. So this is like policy-based design, where the user defines some policies. In this case, it's the list of components, tags, and signatures. We wrap them inside a settings class, and then we use that setting class all inside the framework to get the correct types at compile time. An example of this is just having a list of my components, my tags, and my signatures, which are simple type aliases for compile time list of types. We put them inside the settings, and we alias the settings themselves. And then when we instantiate the manager, we would pass those settings to the manager. So it's a way of defining how our framework should behave at compile time, and we allow the user to do that. So our list classes will be simple wrappers around metaprogramming type lists. So any kind of metaprogramming library supports operational type lists. So the signature will just be a type list of components and tags. The signature list will be a type list of signatures. I'm not making checks here at compile time if the types are correct, but obviously that would be done in a more serious implementation. Components and tags will require no specific library code. They are just simple structs, and the user can define them how he wants. An example is just defining like simple components C0 and C1 with some data inside them, and the tags T0 and T1 with nothing inside them. And then we just pass them inside the component list and tag list, and eventually those will be put into the settings struct. So we basically define, we are telling the compiler how our data structures should be generated for our component type and tag types and so on. So as you can see, component lists and tag lists are just aliases for the type list. So if you're not using two variable templates, this is just a way of wrapping multiple types inside a class that we can use at compile time to do operations such as checking if it contains a specific type or filtering it via some compile time predicate. It's very simple. Then we'll use std bitset to keep track of what components and tags an entity currently has. Since we're using this type list, we can assign a unique ID to every component type and tag type, which is actually the index of the type inside the list. And since that goes from zero to the number of components, and from zero to the number of tags, we can just create a bit set where every bit of the bit set represents the availability of a specific component or tag. To store these bit sets, we will have a helper class called signature bit sets that won't be instantiated, but will help us do some metaprogramming for the bit set types, and a signature bit set storage that will be actually instantiated in the context manager class, and that's where the signature will find out what the bit set, where their bit sets are. So that's where we actually store the bit sets. So let's start implementing our settings class. That was just a forward declaration, so now we have to implement it. And there's a typo here, sorry. So we pass the component list, the tag list, and the signature list, and we alias them inside the settings class. We also alias our own type, as we're going to pass that to the signature bit sets and signature bit sets storage classes. Then we define some type traits like functions that will check if a specific type T is a component, a tag, or a signature. And we do that by simply checking if the tag is contained inside the metaprogramming type list. It's very simple. Another thing we're doing is counting the components, the tags, and the signatures. And that's another type list operation. We can check the type list operations later if you want to see the implementation and if there's time. And now we have to get some unique IDs for the elements, and that's done by basically iterating over the types at compile time and finding out where the type is, and that's just the index of the type inside the type list. And we can do that for the components, the tags, and the signatures. Notice that these functions are candidates for C++ 14 variable templates. Unfortunately, there was a bug present in both Clang and GCC that have reported that make it impossible to use variable templates, so we are just using functions that are constex, prostatic, and noxet. Now we have to define the bitset type, which is just a bitset big enough to contain all the component types and the tag types. And we also want to define two functions, one to get the correct bit for a specific component, and one to get the correct bit for a specific tag. And we do that by getting just the index of the component for the component bit. And for the tag, we're just going to get the count of the components plus the ID of the tag. So that means that the bit set will store the components on the left and the tags on the right. That's basically it. Now we're going to implement the helper signature bit sets class. As you can see, this pattern will be very common throughout the framework. We pass the settings class, the settings type, sorry, to our inner framework classes. And the settings will be already instantiated with the correct list. So that's where we get the information to generate compile time structures. And in the case of signature bit sets, we want to define a type alias that is actually a tuple big enough to contain a bit set for every signature. So we want to get, we want to match the signatures with their own bit sets at compile time. And to do that, we can use that std tuple and std get. So if we have like 10 signatures, we will have an std tuple with 10 bit sets. And by using std get and the ID of the signature, we can get the matching bit set. To do that, we can actually use another metaprogramming feature that's frequent in every metaprogramming library, which is repeat. And we actually generate a type list by repeating the same type a number of times. In this case, we will repeat the bit set type, which is the bit set that we've defined in the setting class, a number of times equal to the count of the signatures. So we will have a bit set for every signature. Now what we need to do is simply wrap this type list inside a tuple so that we can actually access the data at runtime and compile time. We need to filter at compile time whether or not the elements of a signature are components or tags, as a signature can be a mixed bag of components and tags. And to do that, we're going to use yet another metaprogramming feature that is filter. And what we do is basically define some types that will return true or false at compile time, whether or not a predicate is matched. The predicates are those function, type tree-like function that we add in our settings class. So we will just define an integral constant that will return a Boolean if the type T is a component, and one for the tags. And now we can just filter
the elements of a signature. If you recall, the signature is just a type list of types. We can filter those types using the isComponent filter and isStack filter. And what we will get is another type list with only the types that were matching the predicate. So we're just getting those mixed components and tags from the signature, and we're filtering them into separate lists. We're partitioning them. And we will need this for the next code segments. The other missing piece is the signature bits and storage, which is just the struct that we're going to instantiate inside the manager. And here we just take the bits and storage, which was the std tuple big enough for all the signatures, and add it as a member. And we are defining some functions here to access the correct bitsets. So in this case, get signature bitset will get the correct bitset depending on the type T, and T is a signature. So we statically assert that T is actually a signature. And we use stdget with the signature ID that goes from 0 to the count of signatures. So it is perfectly suitable to use that for our std tuple to get the correct bitset reference from the storage. Now we need to initialize a bitset for a specific signature. So we have this compile time list of components and tags, but we actually have to initialize the bitset at runtime. To do that, we first get a reference to the bitset using the function we just saw, and we also alias the signature components and tags that are the filtered lists for convenience. And now we're going to use a technique, a very interesting technique that I've seen first done by Boost HANA, which is a recently approved library into Boost that does metaprogramming in a very, very interesting way. And basically what we're doing is having a type struct here, which is a zero size struct that just wraps a type, as you can see. And we're going to use this function for types that will take us a type list as a template argument. And it will execute this lambda here for every type inside the compile time list. So it's a very powerful idiom. And what we're doing here is inside for types, for every type inside the compile time list, we're calling this lambda, passing a type wrapper here. Our T will be a type wrapper, so that we can retrieve the type information inside the lambda itself. So I hope it is clear. And we're just going to use this here a macro for syntactic sugar, where it just expands to type name, decal type of T type, which is this inner type wrapped in the zero side struct. So what we're doing is we're looping at runtime over all the signature components, and we're setting the bits using component bit of the type returned by four types to true. So we're actually initializing the bitset so that we know what components and tags the bitset will require to match specific entities. And this is done both for the signature components and the signature tags. Everything clear so far? And lastly, we just need to instantiate every bitset for every signature. So we just loop again over the signature list this time, and we call the initialize bitset function inside this other lambda. So we're actually, when we instantiate this class here, sorry, the signature bitset storage, we just initialize every bitset for every signature. This is a very powerful way of doing this. If we wanted to avoid using this idiom, we would have to use compile time recursion with variety templates, and it's just not fun to work with. It's a lot of boilerplate code. So let's run some compile time and runtime tests now. This is how the user will define components. It will just create some structs and put some data in them, and then it will define my component list, which is a type alias for components list, and it will pass all the types inside the list. This will also be done for the tags and for the signatures as well. As you can see, in the signature variadic types, we can just specify both components and tags. It's just a mix of those two elements. After defining components, tags, and signatures, we will pass all of them to the settings and alias the settings as well. And now we can just make some static asserts and make sure that the counts are correctly calculated, that the IDs are correctly calculated, and so on. We can also try the bitset initialization and make sure that the bitsets are correctly created. So we just run the tests. They should pass. They don't. I probably made some kind of typo somewhere. Oh, yeah. there's a comma MPL somewhere. I don't know. Maybe I just didn't save the file. Okay, test passed. Okay, it worked. So for the next code segment, we'll actually implement the entity class and begin coding our manager class. So the architecture of these two classes will be as such. The entity metadata will be stored contiguously in a vector. Entities can be either alive or dead. And we're going to make sure that we reorder entities via a refresh method so that all alive entities are towards the beginning of the entities vector and all dead entities are towards the end of the entity vector. This is done for performance reasons, as we want to loop as quickly as possible over the alive entities. And it also has other benefits that I'll show you later. Component data will actually be stored contiguously in vectors, as we saw in the previous diagrams, where every vector corresponds to a specific component type. And the data will not be reordered. So even if the entities are shifted around, the entities will update their index to the component data, but the component data will stay where it was previously. We can actually implement in a future implementation a way of compressing component data, maybe to allow more cache friendliness, but it's really not required, so it's not a problem. Now, creating and killing entities will be not reflected in the state of the manager until refresh is called. This is done because we may have a lot of entities, and two entities might kill the same entity, another entity. And if we actually reclaim the memory immediately, and we try to access the entity from another update, we will get into corruption, obviously, because the memory is not there anymore. But by having a refresh method, we just mark the entity as dead and just reclaim the memory after the refresh. So we can give the user like a safe place where all operations can be defined. And after calling refresh, obviously, entities can be dead, and it will need to take care of not accessing the dead memory. Newly created entities won't be updated until refresh is called, but they will be immediately accessible. So if you want to create a new entity, you will just say create entity, and it will return a reference that you can use and add components to it, so you don't have to wait the refresh called. But for consistency with the previous behavior, they will just be updated and matched to signatures only after refresh is called. So I have a diagram here that will hopefully clear these things up. So we are doing an update here in the first section. And during the update, as you can see, all the entities are pointing to the component columns directly above them. Unfortunately, during this update, E0 and E2 died, and E4 was just created. So after the update, we just call refresh. And when calling refresh, what we get is that the components didn't change their position. But by reordering the entities, they will actually point to the components they were pointing before. And the dead entities are now towards the right, and they cannot be accessed anymore. And that memory can be reutilized for other entities. So to make our implementation a little easier and safer, we're going to use strong type defs for the indices of the components. In this case, it's data index. And these are the indices of the columns. And also for the entity metadata. So strong type def is just a type alias that makes a completely new type with the same semantics as the original type, in this case, size T. My implementation is very similar to Boost's strong type def. And this is useful because we can overload functions with these types and also for additional safety. The entity class will be a metadata lightweight class. It will need to know what the bitset is, so we pass the settings inside the entity as a template parameter, and the entity instances will contain the index of the component storage column they are pointing to, the bitsets, so we can keep track of the current components and tags, and a flag to determine whether or not the entity is alive and if it needs to be destroyed during the next refresh. So let's move on to the manager. The manager as well will obviously take the settings struct as a template parameter. We will define some type aliases here for convenience. And what we're doing in a manager is having three separate counts. One is capacity, which is how many entities can we actually store before resizing our inner storage. One is size, that only takes into account alive entities that we're not creating during this update. And size next will take into account the entities that have been creating during a specific update, but not yet, but before a refresh. So they are not yet taken into account by size. This is easier to understand via this diagram. So size points to entities that are valid during the current update. Size next points to entities that have been newly created. And capacity is just how many entities we can store inside our vectors before having to reallocate. When we call refresh, obviously after reordering, size and size next will be the same. So for the entities, we will just use an SCD vector. And we will also have to instantiate our signature bits at storage, which was the storage for matching the signatures to the bitsets. We will need some helper methods here that will deal with the growth and reallocation of memory. In this case, we have a growTo method with capacity here. We make sure that our new capacity is bigger than the old one, and we resize the entities vector. And after resizing, we have to initialize the newly allocated entities by making basically them point to the column directly above them, and resetting the bitset and setting them to that, to alive, their alive flag to false. And then we just update the capacity. We also have a convenient method called grow if needed that will just check if we have enough room to make a new entity, and if we don't, it just grow by a fixed amount, something like a CD vector. We need some safe methods to retrieve entities via entity index, and what those methods do is just assert that the index is valid, so it isn't smaller than size next, and it will return the entity from the vector themselves. So we'll actually grow to a fixed amount of memory upon construction, and now we can actually start defining the methods that the user will actually call to interface himself with the component system. So they are very pretty self-explanatory. We have the isAlive method that will take an entity index and return whether or not that entity is alive. We have the kill method that will mark that entity as dead for the next refresh. And then we have operation to add, remove, check tags. And those will be simple bitset operations. We make sure that the type we're passing to these functions is actually a tag and just return or set the corresponding bitset bit inside the entity metadata. Checking a removing component as well are very simple bitset operations. To check if we have a component, we just check the component bit, and to remove it, we set it to false. To actually implement the addition and retrieval of components, we need to implement the component storage first, and we will do that in a separate code segment. So to create entities, we will have a create index method that will actually create an entity and return the index to the newly created entity. We will start by reallocating memory if it's required by the grow if needed method. Then we will get the first available metadata index, which is just size next plus plus, because if you remember the diagram, it's the first cell with no data that can actually be used. We assert that the data we're using is actually dead, and then we initialize the metadata for the entity. And we do that by setting the alive flag to true, resetting the bitset. Then we can just return the index so that the user can add components to the entity and do something with it. We'll also have a clear method that will just reinitialize everything. We'll make the entities point to the columns above for the components and set the sizes to zero, so it's very simple. Now, the interesting algorithm is the refresh method. It will actually be composed of two functions. One is the interface function called by the user, which is refresh, and the refresh simple function will actually deal with all the reordering and the tricky stuff. So the interface function will exit early if we have no new entities, because we do not have to do anything. It's all already in order. Otherwise, it will set both size and size next to the value returned by refresh simple. So as you can see, when we call refresh, size and size next have to match because we reorder the entities and the new entities actually become tracked by the manager. So the size next will be the same as size. And the returned value here is calculated by basically using two different iterators, indices. One that goes from the left to the right and looks for dead entities, and one that goes from the right to the left and looks for alive entities. When these indices find the entities they're looking for, they swap them, so that all dead entities will be at the end of the vector and all live entities will be at the beginning of the vector. And eventually, those two indices will cross. And when they cross each other, we know where we have to stop the algorithm and we know what value size and size next will be. Obviously, I have a diagram for this. So as you can see, we have the ID and IA iterators. ID moves towards the right, IA moves towards the left. ID looks for dead entities, and IA looks for alive entities. In this case, ID found a suitable entity here, and IA found a suitable entity here, so they're going to be swapped. And the iterators continue forward until we get in a situation where all alive entities are on the left, and all dead entities are on the right, and the memory for the dead entities can be reused in the future. And as you can see, when IA and ID cross, we get the correct number of alive entities. So that's what we're interested in, to return to the refresh function. The implementation of the algorithm looks like this. Basically, we have a while through loop, and we have two inner loops that move the ID and IA iterator, until they find the entities they're looking for. This one looks for a dead entity from the left. This one looks for a dead entity from the right. And after we exit those four loops, we actually get to the point where both iterators found a suitable entity. So we assert that with some simple checks here. And we swap the entities and move both iterators forward. Eventually, after we get out of this loop, when ID has crossed IA or IA was crossed by ID, we will actually return the value of the iterator. So we know how many alive entities are in the vector. And that's basically it. We'll also have some methods to return the count of entities and the capacity of the manager, and just something to print the state of the manager for debugging. So there are some things still missing. So obviously, we are missing components, we're missing handles, and entity signature matching. But before implementing those, let's just run some tests and see how the algorithm works in a real situation. So you can see the syntax is, after defining the manager type and all the components in the compile time list, we instantiate the manager, and we can create entities by getting the return value of create index. So we get the index of the new entity. And we can add tags and remove tags from the entities by using the add tag and deal tag functions, passing the type of the tag as a template parameter and the entity index as a regular parameter. And here we are checking that everything works properly. One thing to take notice of is that here we create two entities, i0 and i1, but unless we call refresh, the entity count will be 0, just to stay consistent with the death behavior of the entities. So after calling refresh, we will actually make sure that the entity count is 2. So here I just create random entities and destroy entities randomly just to show some output, and hopefully I'll be able to show you how the refresh algorithm works in practice. Okay, let me find some examples. So for example, before test iteration 17 refresh, here we have a difference between size and size next. That means that the last entity was just created during this iteration, maybe. Okay. And after calling refresh, the two dead entities are shifted towards the right, and their memory is reclaimed. And size and size next will point to the same index. So we know how many entities are alive inside the vector. And that's it. Any questions so far? Sure.
Is it a problem that for that reordering algorithm, your indices kind of get mixed up? Because, I mean, you don't have them consecutively adding, right? Because if you have entity A with ID 20 at the end, and then you have one dead entity at the beginning, the 20 ID entity goes to the beginning, and then when you iterate over it, it goes to the end of your components. And is this a problem?
So the question is, if it is a problem that the entity metadata gets reordered inside the vector, because maybe your program could be dependent on the order of the entities, but that's very often not a problem. Actually, you shouldn't design your application to rely on the order of the metadata, if that was the question.
Not so much about the order in the sense that it matters, but while traversing. You design the right?
Yeah.
If we traverse in a random order, it's not as friendly as if we just traverse linearly, right?
So I've actually benchmarked it, and the problem is that if you do not reorder the entities, you have to check whether or not they are alive or dead. So you have some branches there, and it's actually faster to have this design of having the refresh function, which deals with the reordering just once, so it will never be a bottleneck in your application. And then being able to iterate over all alive entities without any kind of branch is actually better in this situation. I hope that answers the question. So we are missing the component storage and the entity signature matching and the handles. In this code segment, we'll implement the first two. Okay, I just have 15 minutes, so I'll hope to go a little faster now. The component storage will just be a one array per component type. So what we have seen in the previous diagrams, and what we're doing here is using a type alias here that takes a variadic amount of types called tuple of vectors that will just use the ellipsis operator to expand the types inside a CD tuple of a CD vector. So if we pass int and double in here, we will get an std tuple of vector of int and vector of double. The types are expanded not inside the vector, but the vectors are expanded inside the tuple. Now we need to unpack the types of the components that are in the component list type list with this type alias. To do that, we're going to use another metaprogramming common feature, which is rename. Basically, when we have a type list, we have type list with some type in it. We just take that type list away and put something in place of it. In this case, we are putting tuple of vectors. So I will actually get this type alias instantiated with the types inside the component list. So what we actually get is an std tuple of std vector, where every vector is suitable for a specific component type, and those types are in the component list. That's it. That's our storage. As you can see, it's very easy to implement. We need some interface functions to grow every vector and to get a specific component via that data index. And that's just iteration over tuples. Please come to my talk on Thursday for each argument to see how this is implemented. And what we actually do is loop over every element of the tuple and grow the vector inside it. And we also need a function to get the component. Now, the problem is that we actually need to get to use a std getter with vector of t. And fortunately, we can use a C++14 and just specify the type inside a cdget instead of an index, and we will actually get the correct tuple element. And after doing that, we can just go inside the vector and get the correct component. So the component storage will be instantiated inside the manager, as you can see here. And we have to remember to grow the storage inside the grow_to function and also clear it in the clear function. Now we can implement add component and get component. Add component will take the type of the component t and a number of variadic templates that will be forwarded to the component constructor. We make sure that t is a component, and we set the bit to true, and we forward the passed arguments inside the constructor of t, which is the component, using placement new in the memory location returned by the component storage. So this can be flexible, as if you want to change the type of component storage, maybe to the mega array, you do not have to change the manager implementation. Now for get component, we assert that the type is a component and that the bit is set to true, so we will not get invalid components. And we will retrieve it using the getComponent function inside the component storage. And that's it. Now we get to a very interesting part, which is the signature matching. We want to get all the entities matching a specific signature. To do that, we have a function that returns true or false, depending on whether or not an entity matches a signature. And what we're doing here is using bitsets operation to figure out whether or not that's true. So if the signature has those two bits here, and the entity has those bits, we simply do a bitwise AND between the bit sets. And if the bitwise AND is equal to the signature bit sets, then it matches the signature. You can think of this as, does the entity bit set contain the signature bit sets? That's the operation we're doing. We're checking if all the bits in the signature are contained in the entity. And if that's true, the entity matches the signature. Now we need to iterate over all alive entities and all alive entities matching a specific signature. So this is where I like to pass the functions, because we do not have to deal with the indices in the user code. We just pass the function that we want to be executed for every entity into four entities, and it will deal with the looping and just execute the function. Now, for the entities matching, we can do something really interesting. Since we know what components are in the signature, we can actually just expand the component references directly into the function call, so that the user doesn't have to call get component T1, get component T2, get component T3. We can just pass them as parameters in the signature function call. To do that, after checking if the entity matches a signature, we use this function expand signature call that will actually get all the components required by the signature, get a reference to those components, and pass them to the user call function, so that the user will not need any boilerplate code. And that requires a helper struct here that takes a variadic amount of types. And the implementation is not that difficult. We just get the required components from the signature. And after doing that, we use rename again to unpack the required components of the signature inside the expand call helper class. So basically, we get all the components required for the signature, and we pass them inside this class here. And we call the call static function, passing the index of the entity, a reference to the manager, and the function that the user wants to be called on the matching entities. Now, the call implementation is this one, and it's actually using the ellipsis operator again to expand the get component function with the parameter pack of all required components and the index of the entity. So that basically what we do is call the function with the index of the entity and a reference to every required component, because we know what components the entity is going to be if it matches a specific signature. So an example here is if we call the function with a signature that has the component C0, C1, and C2, this ellipsis operator here will get expanded to three different calls to get component, where the types are changed to C0, C1, and C2. So we're actually calling the user function with the components that we know the entity has for sure. And this is done to reduce boilerplate, because the user otherwise would have to get component C0, C1, C2 in its code. So it's just a waste of time. That's basically it. So we're just going to implement a particle simulation to show you how to work with components. And we define a position, velocity, acceleration, and life components, which are simple structs with some data in them. In this case, vec2f is just a mathematical bidimensional vector of x and y. And life is a float value that will determine the life of the particle. We also have a crender component here that will render a shape using SFML. And we put those components inside the list. We won't need any tags for this example, so tag list is just an empty list. Now we define our signatures. So apply velocity will be a signature that will add velocity to position. So this signature requires position and velocity. Apply acceleration will add acceleration to velocity. So this signature requires velocity and acceleration. Rendering, on the other hand, just requires the position and the render component. So now you can start thinking about the flexibility of this approach. Maybe an entity will not have a velocity and an acceleration, but it can still be rendered if it has the position component. So you can mix and match these components together, and the behavior will be flexible and based upon the signatures. Now we'll also have a signature that will just match C-life to decrement the life of the particles, and one that will match C-render and C-life to make the shape smaller as the particle reaches its death. So we just set the signatures in here, we set the settings, and to create particles, we just call the createIndex function that will return an index for our entity, and we get references to the components of the newly created entity. We add the component, passing the component type in the parameter list and the index of the entity, and we get the value of the component, which was the vector2, and we just take a reference to it so we can set it to a random value. And we do the same with position, velocity, acceleration, and life. So basically, we create entities by composing them with these smaller pieces. And afterwards, this is the power of the automatic matching. You can call manager for entities matching as apply velocity, which was our position and velocity signature. And it will automatically expand inside the function called signature the entity index, which is unused here, and the components that we are sure the entity will have because it matches the specific signature. So in the case of apply velocity, it will actually automatically give the user function a reference to the position and the velocity. So you don't have to call inside the lambda get component position, get component velocity. We know what the components are, we can simply get them. And then we can add the velocity to the position and multiply it by the frame time to make sure that the behavior is consistent on every platform. So we define all of our systems. This is what I mean by implicit systems. We do not have a system class. We just have these matching functions. You could wrap them into a system class if you want to do it. It's OK. Now for the life, we just kill the entity if the value reaches zero. And for rendering, we just set the size of the shape depending on the life. And that's it. Now let's run the example. I need to activate optimizations. That's it. Hopefully, it will work. I'll show you after the demo. So this is our particle simulation. As you can see, we have some data about the number of entities, FPS, and the time spent into update and draw. I've reached more than 50,000 on my home computer, which is more powerful than my laptop. So I guess that's suitable for any kind of small application. And I'm sure you can reach even more extreme values if you use multi-threading, if you take advantage of SteamD operation, and if you try other component storage types like the mega array. And the beauty of the component design is just not having more performance, but this kind of flexibility where you can match behaviors to signatures, so you are not forced to actually think about logic in terms of entities. You think of logic in terms of signatures and systems. So you wanted to see how the life decreases. Basically, we just subtract the value of the C-life component with the frame time, and that's it, basically. One thing that I will not be able to show you because we don't have time, but I want to tell you what next code segment was going to be about is handles. Handles are a layer of indirection between the user and specific entity instances because we may want to track a specific entity and check whether or not it is alive. And we deal with handles by having a new auxiliary data structure, which is the handle data vector. And every handle data has a pointer to its entity and a counter. And what the counter does is it will be incremented if the entity is killed. So when an entity replaces the old entity in the same position, we know the handle will be invalid as the counter was not the same as previously. And the user will have these small objects called handles that are simply small structs containing an index to a specific handle data and a counter. And to get the entity through the handle, the first thing that will be done is check if the counter is equal to the handle data counter. So if the entity has not been destroyed, this check will pass. And afterwards, we can just move from the handle to the handle data and from the handle data to the entity and get the correct entity instance. So the code is all available on my GitHub, and it's very well commented. And if you found the talk interesting, you may want to read it and see the implementation of handles. Hopefully, I'll have time to give you some more information about components. I have here some ideas for the future. So a good idea would be to benchmark alternative data structures. I have yet to implement a mega array structure, but I want to do that and benchmark it. Also, add serialization network and networking capabilities. And that will be very easy, as components are just logicless structs. Another cool thing that may be implemented are events for communication between unrelated entities. That's not really something that is often done, but it may be useful in some kinds of application. Also, we may cache entities during refresh to avoid matching them to signatures every time we call for entities matching. And we could prevent invalidation when creating entities during updates, so you don't have to delay the creation of entities after the refresh. Cool things would be multi-threading. That's harder to implement, but if two entities have completely mismatching signatures, you can actually run the for entities matching on two separate threads asynchronously, and it will work because they do not share any kind of component data. And another cool thing I want to propose is concepts bitsets, as that would remove the need of having the signature bitset storage class. We can just compute the bitset at compile time and get them without any kind of memory overhead. Some resources I've used to make this talk, and that are very interesting and I suggest you read if you're interested in the subject are the tmachineblog.org, which has a lot of very interesting and in-depth articles about data structure, multithreading and networking for entity component systems. This Stack Overflow function has a very in-depth analysis of the benefits of component-based design. And these other links are also very interesting blogs made by people who really know about component systems and have given us a lot of interesting resources and information. So definitely check them out. So that's it. If you have any question, I'm happy to reply. Sure. Okay, so that's the question was that since I'm defining the signatures and the component types at compile time, how would that work if I had an editor like Unity? Well, I actually haven't thought about that, to be honest. I didn't think about the integration of the system with like an editor or a runtime environment. I'm sure something could be done, especially if we get some static reflection features in the newest standards. But that's not what I was aiming for. I wanted a just code framework that can be used. So nice question. I will think about it in the future. So if there are no more questions, thank you for attending. Yeah, sure. So I used that in the OOP implementation, not in the component implementation. And that's usually a very quick way of grouping entities together based on their type. And that causes a performance hit. So that's the problem with polymorphism, because you need to have something, a runtime, to know what type the entity is. So you just have to use type ID or just manually set like a value or flag that will be taken at a runtime. It will always have an overhead in terms of runtime performance. So the question is, I refer to two Boost libraries, which are StrongTypeDefs and HANA. And I'd advise you to use those libraries in your implementation. I actually re-implemented from scratch the functionality that I needed from HANA and from StrongTypeDef. But that was just to make the code as small as possible and to keep compilation time short. But just use the Boost libraries. They are very well done, especially HANA is mind-blowing, so use them. One question?
How do you deal with the fact that some systems might be changing pieces of data that another system is accessing and you might have like ordering issues?
Okay. So the question is, how do you deal with the fact that systems may change data inside entities that other system may need later? And so the problem is there, and it's actually a real problem. If you design your framework correctly, your component types correctly, and you know that the systems are actually called sequentially, so there is no multi-threading, no asynchronously, the problem will not be there unless you cache the entities, because when you call for entities matching, you try again to match the entity, so you do that again. If you do something like problematic, I've run into this in another example, where you like create an entity during an update, and it may reallocate the vector. A good idea of solving that is having like a delegate, a list, a vector of std function, where you put them some function that will create entities or change something in the entities and call that after refresh. Because after refresh is called, you can do anything you want. And the overhead is minimal, as those are operations that will be called once after the refresh. So it's not the best solution. I'm looking for something better, but the problem is that actually. Yeah. One question?
So in runtime, do you have like a tuple of bit sets, or do you merge them all into one large bit set? And do you have to deal with like alignments?
So I actually have a tuple of bit sets, and that's the tuple used to match the bit sets to their specific signatures. And I generate that at compile time by repeating the bit set type inside the tuple n times, where n is the count of signatures. And I can actually get the correct bit set by using a cdget with the ID of the signature. This would be much better if we had constex bit sets, so I could like define the bit set inside the type of the signature itself. So I hope that answers your question. I actually have an STD tuple of bit sets. So I think we ran out of time. So thank you very much for attending. Have a nice conference.